IndieCast is presented by Uproxx's Indie Mixtape. Hello, everyone, and welcome to IndieCast. On the show, we talk about the biggest indie news of the week, we review albums, and we hash out trends. In this episode, we review the new album by Howdy, and we rant about Oasis getting snubbed by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or at least I will rant about that. My name is Stephen Hayden, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host. He tricked me into taking Taylor Swift on my fantasy albums team, Ian Cohen. Ian, how are you?
Yeah, you know Taylor's down bad on this album rollout because I started to see her Twitter account retweet positive reviews, which I haven't seen.
What?
I think there was one from Uproxx, one from Billboard. I know that. I know that she did this. I want to say it was either like 2014 or 2016, and you would just see these writers absolutely glowing. And I think, like, rightfully so, that like Taylor Swift acknowledged their positive review.
Right.
I think that was like Reputation, maybe that was happening with that.
Well, for her album Lover, she actually posted things on Instagram, thanking individual writers for their reviews, which is one of the sadder moments, I think, in music criticism when people were really excited about that. So, I checked Metacritic last week on Friday when the latest Taylor Swift album came out, The Tortured Poets Department, which, if you don't know, this album dropped on Friday, 15 songs, and then like 2 hours later, Taylor Swift's like, here's 15 more songs.
Cindy Lee coded.
Yeah. Well, yeah, except Taylor Swift is doing this all the time. It's just like more slop. Here's more slop for you. I'm just going to throw you more slop. You public, you can't get enough of me. When I checked Metacritic on Friday, and now I'm doubting my memory, but I swear it had like a 92.
It was up there. It was like all raves. Like those were the first ones to drop.
Yeah, and I might have even said something to you. Maybe I'd have to go scroll through the DMs, but I think I was even gloating a little bit. Like, oh, look at this. I am going to cruise to victory. Taylor Swift coming through. Now, for those who remember our most recent draft, Ian and I were both reluctant to take Taylor Swift because we were thinking, oh, this might be the backlash record. You know, she's just been getting tons of positive press for years now. She's due for a market correction. Also, the rollout for this album, some of the advanced lyrics that were released, it looked like kind of a stinker in advance. You know, there was some cringy lyrics being shared. But then the album drops, and you start seeing these reviews that we've seen for every Taylor Swift album. It is somehow, again, her best album in years, her most personal album, her most, you know,
daring
statement. Yeah. Most daring. She's addressing the pitfalls of celebrity, the loneliness of being the most famous person in the world, yada, yada, yada. I checked Metacritic the other day. This album dropped to a 77.
Yeah, Black Monday, man. Like,
15-point drop. Is this unprecedented? I've never seen this for, like, a major record. Sometimes, you know, you drop, like, 2 or 3 points, maybe 5. 15 points? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And look, I would kind of be excited about this, except it's affecting my fantasy team. And, you know, look, I'm going to make a couple quarterback analogies in this episode, just a fair warning to people. This album is Mac Jones.
Ooh.
This album had a good first season and then fell off a cliff. And now, you know, it's journeyman status now for Mac Jones. That's what this album is. Except I'm the one who drafted Mac Jones. She's killing me here.
I think this is more of an RG3 type comparison because, you know, Robert Griffin Jr. just, you know, Mac Jones was like serviceable for a year, but like Robert Griffin,
he made the playoffs though.
Yeah, he busted it. Like the Redskins put him on the field, even though he had like a busted knee, and then he like never was the same. And now he's like, but he had a happy ending. He's on TV killing it.
Yeah, you're talking about RG3. I mean, the Mac Jones analogy I would just make because he was good in his first year. There were people thinking, oh, he's going to be the Tom Brady replacement, and then just fell off a cliff, just terrible. And now he's a backup to Trevor Lawrence, I think, right?
Yes.
I think he's in
Traded for a 6-round draft pick. Yeah, we're doing NFL draft cast. Today is the first round, so yeah.
The day that we're recording is the draft. It'll be the second day by the time this episode posts. But yeah, just an incredible drop. It is interesting when you have these big albums that come out and critics rush out to say it's great, and then immediately there's like a second wave of people saying, not so fast. This actually isn't great. I mean, to me, the example that comes immediately to mind is Be Here Now, Oasis. Like, that album came out. Every British magazine is like 5 out of 5 stars. Best album since Sgt. Pepper. You know, this is the second coming. And then came the next wave of reviews saying, oh, it's too long, it's bloated, the, you know, fame has gone to these people's heads. I mean, I think it's somewhere in the middle with Be Here Now. I mean, I love Be Here Now. Yeah. It's not the greatest album of all time. It's not the worst. This album is certainly bloated, though, to Be Here Now levels, this Taylor Swift record.
Is there anything really as good as, like, Magic Pie on this or My Big Mouth? But, yeah, Be Here Now might be one of the greatest bad albums ever, but, you know...
Yeah, I mean, like, because, like, bad Noel Gallagher lyrics are funny.
Yes.
Whereas the Taylor Swift bad lyrics are just embarrassing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just fascinating how... Like, I think that we somewhat predicted that there would be, like, this division on this album where, you know, some of the more pop-focused, celebrity-focused publications continue to love it, and maybe some of the, you know, more indie ones feel comfortable taking their shots because, like, under that cover. But just the way it was all portioned out, like you were saying, it was all raves and then the backlash, and, like... I think at the beginning, like, our pal Larry Fitzmaurice called it, like, the beatings will continue until morale improves type flair. But, the raves to me have, like, a vote blue no matter who type energy where it's, like, you cannot hold your leader accountable for just, like, any bad things that they do. Or the things that, like, you would absolutely find intolerable if, like, anyone else did them.
Yeah, right. There's also the matter of people... publishing reviews on Friday when the album dropped at midnight. Now, I don't know if they had advances. I really doubt that they did. I don't think there were advances for this album. I know it leaked.
Oh.
So maybe people heard the leak. But it just seems like, and God bless these people, I know that that's their assignment, but it's like they were just up all night listening to Taylor Swift and then writing their review, like, immediately. I mean, I actually think that you could have waited a few days and still been okay. I know you want to be the first one in, but, like, with this kind of record, I feel like you don't need to have something immediately. Although there were some great reviews that people did. I mean, shout out Tom Bryan at Stereo Gum. He wrote a great review, and he must have just been...
up all night.
Yeah, you know, Ivy of Joe Cola laced with cocaine or something, like, just to stay up. And do that. I thought his review was very thoughtful.
Yeah, shout out to Tom. He fascinates me because he does shit like this all the time with, like, 2-hour-long pop and rap records. Like, by the next morning, they're published. Well, and he's kids and shit, too. Yeah.
He's a pro, though. He's been in the, you know, look, and we're out there. He's in my generation. Got the pros here, you know, from the online salt mines back in the day.
The adults are talking,
Shout out to Tom. One review that dragged down the score came from Paste. It's actually the lowest review on Metacritic. They gave it a 36. I don't know how they come up with these numbers because there's no rating. There's no rating on Paste. I don't know how they came.
There are 36. Actually. Paste does have Paste.
Oh,
does
they do.
Yeah, they do.
Okay. So is it on a number scale or
stars? Yeah, it's like a 10 scale if I'm not mistaken. At least that's what it was when I'm looking at it here, rating. Yeah, it's in a little blue box on the top right-hand corner.
Okay, my mistake. Okay, so they did give it a rating. I mean, a lot of these places don't give ratings. Like the New York Times doesn't give a rating, and somehow on Metacritic it has a 60. I don't know how they came upon 60. They just read their pros and were counting the insults, I guess, and detracted that from 100. I don't know what that is. But Paste, That review was one of the reviews that went viral, and I think a big reason why it went viral is that Pace decided not to put a byline on the review. And the rationale given at the top of the review is that our critics in the past have been given too many threats online, and we don't want to put them in danger, so we're not putting a byline on this review. All due respect, I hate that.
Yeah.
I really hate that. I think if you don't put a byline on a review, it's not music criticism, it's an internet comment. And look, that review, like, I don't want to get into the pros of it or the opinions or whatever. I mean, it begins with a questionable, if I can be polite, suicide joke about Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if there was a byline on this review, I don't think you make that joke. I think you would think, okay, people are going to call me out personally if I make a suicide joke, so maybe I won't do it. And that's actually one of the good things about online accountability. And I'll put myself in this. I have made questionable jokes in reviews. People have called me out on it. And I was like, you're right. I shouldn't have done that. That's a good thing. Sometimes you need to be checked. There are people online who are just lunatics and they go after you for no good reason because you didn't like a record. That's awful. But sometimes there's people online who call you out. You should be called out. You know, you're a perpetual line stepper, to quote Charlie Murphy. You've crossed the line and you need to be called out. I just don't think it's right to write a record review and not be accountable for it. If you are that concerned about your staff being threatened by people on the internet, which is a legitimate concern, just don't run a review. You know, you're not, this isn't like Lyndon Johnson sending you to Vietnam because of the draft. There is no rock critic draft. You know, you can decide not to take the assignment if you feel like it's not worth it. But to not put your name on it, I just think it's cowardly not to do that. Especially when you do have people who did write critically of this record, who did put their names on their reviews, and they took the consequences of it, because that's the job. You know, sometimes you say things that aren't popular and people are going to come after you and it sucks, but you know, it's part of the gig. I just don't think, you know, especially if it's like a, because that was like a hatchet job, that review. It was like really negative. So to be really negative and then not say who wrote it, I don't know. That just seems weak to me.
Yeah, maybe like Pace just doesn't run a review because they're too shook, and then we spend the next 10 years talking about it, like how Pitchfork didn't review 1984 or whatever.
1989.
Fuck, man. Yeah, they haven't reviewed Van Halen either. So
I was gonna say, you're always confusing George Orwell and Taylor Swift. It's very easy to get them mixed up.
Yeah, I was thinking more like Van Halen, but like if Pitchfork had a byline on their review, Pace can do it too. With all due respect, man. And like, I think my bigger issue is that it was, like you said, not even a good review. It read like, and I'm gonna do a real fucking deep cut from like the OG, you know, me and Tom Bryan on Blogspot era. That like read like something like you would see Byron Crawford do in like 2005. Wow. Yeah, I know, deep cut right there. It's just like, these jokes aren't funny. It's just like this idea of like, oh, this is what the game is missing in music writing. And it's like, no, we don't miss that, you know? Because like, look, I've done that. I've been there. I am glad I did that back in like, say, 2005 rather than 2015. We all have shit that we embarrass ourselves with if you stay in this game long enough. But at the end of the day, though, I do appreciate the overall impact on the score. You know, if we're talking about a music writer draft, you know, the only one that matters.
That review was the Robert Griffin knee injury for me. So, you know, I guess I resent it on that level too. Yeah, I just want to say, you know, I've seen this sentiment online among the younger generation about hating and like bringing back hating. And look, I understand where that comes from, because we are in an era where it seems like a lot of press coverage about very famous artists is overwhelmingly positive to like a super annoying degree. And when you see that all the time, you feel like, I want to do the opposite of this. I want to take a hatchet to this. But The opposite of dumb discourse is not more dumb discourse, okay? And, like, a lot of blind hating is just as dumb as blind adoration. You know, you can criticize something and do it, like, in a smart, thoughtful way. I think just, like, being really mean is, like, not the solution to the discourse issues that we are having in this moment in time. Yeah. Even though, again, I understand the visceral enjoyment of that. Like, it is a short-term thrill to see someone that you feel like is being overpraised being taken down a peg. But, like, in the long run, it's, like, not, it's not a positive thing.
Didn't Taylor Swift write a song called Mean about,
who right. was it? It was Bob Lefsetz.
That's right. About. Yeah, we're going to get Mean, we're going to get, like, Mean Part 2, if whatever album that is, once she, like, finally re-records it. Like, that's going to, it's going to be, like, the biggest thing ever to happen to Paste Magazine.
Yeah, or maybe she'll cover Rude by Magic, you know?
Like, nah, she'll, this like, bring that song. Yeah.
It's like, why you got to be so rude? Music critics.
Yeah, and they'll just change the entire lyrics. Too? Yeah.
I want to do a quick follow-up on what we were talking about last week. We were both going to some big shows, polar opposite of each other. You went to go see indie phenom Cindy Lee in mm-hmm. San Diego, and I went to go see Phish in Las Vegas. I'm really curious about the Cindy Lee show, because I love the record, and also because it's not coming anywhere near me. Like, what was that like? I mean, I would imagine it was probably pretty packed.
Yeah, it was sold out. It was a real... the piece I wrote about this for Stereo Gum, like, literally just posted. So, you know, I'm hoping that I don't get some sort of weird backlash for things I say in there. I don't think I said anything off the rails. But nonetheless, it's a little unnerving whenever you go big picture. But, yeah, this show was on sale for, like, 2 months when I got tickets. Like, about 2 minutes after the review dropped on Pitchfork, I'm like, fuck, I better get on this. And I bought tickets. Total cost, $25.
Wow.
Yeah, and like 12 hours later, the show was sold out. That happened everywhere. It was a show where, like, a lot of my real life friends with whom I discuss music are like 30 to 45 year old indie people who, like, used to read, you know, Pitchfork and Stereo Gum in college and just kind of stopped eventually. And they were all at this show. It was like the most, it was like the biggest in real life friend hangout I've had in quite some time. And yeah, it was sold out, but it's like at a, you know, it's at a venue where you can see, like, you can see Hotline, TNT, Cloud Nothings are coming there. And, look, the show started at 8:30. It was a 3-band bill, and it was over by 10:30. 5 stars. Cindy Lee's been playing the same 10-song set in each city, over backing tracks. By the way, I want to give a recommendation to the opener, Freak Heat Waves there. They're kind of part of that universe. Cindy Lee does some vocals on their stuff, and it sounds really awesome. I got to recommend them. But yes, you know, Cindy Lee played guitar. Amazing guitar player. It really comes alive when you see it, because, you know, they have the same sort of deadpan, gum-chewing face. It's like this kind of purposefully blasé appearance that's part of the persona, but... Yeah, it was crowded. People were recording on their phones. Like, Cindy Lee would mill about the crowd, like, you know, smoking and, like, hanging by the soundboard, nobody punishing them. But, like, the one piece of stage banter I caught was them saying, "I feel like a caged fucking animal," which I don't know if that's part of the bit. I don't know a ton about the Cindy Lee persona. I've heard that this is their last tour as Cindy Lee and that they might retire the moniker. I think that was maybe even the case before Diamond Jubilee dropped, but... Most people loved it. Like, I thought it was a cool show. A lot of people thought it was a cool show, you know, because this is someone who's been around for a while. This is not like seeing Waves or, you know, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah back in, like, when they got blown up super quick. Like, Cindy Lee, to the degree that they are blowing up, like, they're prepared for this moment.
Yeah, again, I think it should be reiterated that I really don't think there was a plan in place to... create a phenomenon that would, you know, springboard Cindy Lee to stardom. I mean, this really does feel like an accident in a lot of ways. And, you know, that caged animal line is interesting. I mean, I know It was announced, I think, before this tour started, like on that GeoCities website, that this was going to be the last tour. So I don't think it's a reaction to all the attention that Diamond Jubilee has gotten this month. I'll be curious to see if there is a reaction to that success, and maybe it won't be the last tour. Maybe it'll be like, oh, I'll keep this going. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if it's not. But I don't know. I've only seen YouTube clips of the live performances, and it's like very intriguing. It's a very theatrical show, it seems like.
Yeah, but I mean, I felt like a caged animal at that venue too. The soda bar, look, man, it's like the sort of, there's a bar running through the middle of the venue. Like, you'll see the saddest mosh pits there because, like, you can't gather more than 10 people in any given space. And if you're like shorter than 6 feet tall and not at the front of the stage, you can't see shit. So
aren't all mosh pits in 2024 kind of sad? At this point, like, we're still moshing. We're still doing this.
I heard people were trying to mosh to Hotline TNT. You can't do that, man. Like, not, I get it, but not that band.
Come on. Settle down. Channel your aggression elsewhere. There was no moshing at Phish.
Let's open up this fucking pit. Here's bouncing around the room.
There might have been on the floor. I was in the 200 level, which is the best, I think, section to be in, because you could see the band and you can also see the enormous screen. I wrote a long column about my experience at the Sphere on 420 weekend watching Phish. So please go to UpRocks and check that out. You forgot to plug yourself. Didn't you write something about the Cindy Lee show?
I did. It's on Stereo Gum.
It's probably up by the time
this it posted like while you were doing the intro. I got the email about that.
Oh, there you go. Okay, I stumbled a few times recording the intro, which you won't hear. I must have gotten a disturbance in the force that there was new Ian Cohen content on the internet. I wrote about this in my column. You know, I've now seen U2 and Phish at Sphere. I'm 2 for 2 on Sphere shows. Dead & Co is next. I don't have a current plan to see Dead & Co, but never say never. Could make it 3 for 3. One interesting thing I think about going to these shows is how quickly you get acclimated to the screen and seeing these amazing images on screen. And look, there was some incredible stuff. You know, there was one particular song, it was a newer song called Pillow Jets, good tune, where on the screen behind Phish there was like this sort of forest landscape, and then as the band started to jam, the trees turned into like fireworks and the ground turned into like this molten lava thing. And it was doing that for about 10 minutes, and then the band stopped jamming and went back to the song, and then it went back to what was the original forest landscape. Describing it does not do it justice. I'm guessing this does not sound amazing as it was to see, but it was incredible. But the thing is, it's like you see something like that, and then like the next song, it'll just be like a photorealistic image of a mountain. And yeah, it looks cool, but it's easy to lose sight of like how technically amazing a lot of this stuff is because you just get used to it. It's like any kind of technology. You know, it used to be amazing that you could have an iPod and have 500 songs in your pocket. Like, people just went nuts about that. And now people have like a billion songs in their pocket and they're like, oh, where's the good music? I can't find music. You know, the terrible thing about technology and the wonderful thing about technology is that it brings these wonderful things into the world that we immediately find boring once we find it, once we're around it enough. And I'm not saying Sphere was boring. I'm just saying it's an interesting dynamic there with the imagery. I have to say, too, the sound there is incredible. And it was even better for this show than it was for U2. And I think, I mean, Phish was like very particular about the sound, and like they built a mini sphere in the rehearsal space so they could make sure every seat in the house had like great sound. But it really was like listening to music on your headphones, except you're in a concert venue. And at the end of like the last show, like Trey came out and like thanked everyone that worked on the shows. It's the first time I've ever been like in an arena where you could actually understand the person talking on stage. You know, normally like someone's on stage and they're talking and it just sounds like and then maybe they say the name of your town and you recognize that and everyone cheers. Crystal clear. Trey's thank yous. It was unbelievable. So, I don't know. I wrote a lot more in my column, 4,000 words. So if there's people out there in IndyCast land that want to read 4,000 words on fish at the Sphere, you can do it on UpRocks.
Yeah.
And you could read about Cindy Lee on Stereo Gum, written by Ian.
I think I did about 25 hundo on that one.
There you go.
Because, yeah, it's a lot of what we talk about when we talk about, you know, conversation there. And I just love how when you were describing the Sphere, like the trees turned into mountains, I'm like, damn, you are like creating some of the best post-rock band names and you don't even know it.
That's right. That's right. Beautiful thing. All right. I got to rant about something here, Ian, a little bit.
Tell them why you're mad, son.
Well, okay, so the news about the latest class of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame dropped when I was in Las Vegas. It was on Sunday, I believe. And I was right before I was going to go down to the Sphere to see the band. It was right around the time I saw your pal,
yep.
Ian. Shout out Jamil. Great to meet you last weekend. By the way, I was asking this is a friend of Ian's from college. I was asking him for embarrassing Ian college stories that I could share on the podcast, and he would not give it up. So he's a good friend.
Yeah, he'd probably end up snitching on himself if he told any stories about me, because he's in a lot of them. He could just tell you about how the summer we spent listening to like Junior Senior's album on repeat and watching Clerks the Animated Series. That's the sort of trouble we got into in college.
So, for those who don't know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class was announced last week, and the inductees are Mary J. Blige, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Kool and the Gang, Ozzy Osbourne, and A Tribe Called Quest. Now, I am and I should also say there's also some inductees in the Musical Excellence Award. These are people who weren't voted in, but they were just appointed to go in. And that's Jimmy Buffett, MC5, Dionne Warwick, and Norman Whitfield. A dream blunt rotation, if there ever was one. So, as I've discussed previously on the show, I am a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voter. I voted for three of the people that were inducted this year. I voted for Kool and the Gang. I voted for Ozzy Osbourne. And I voted for A Tribe Called Quest. So, congratulations to those three. Love all those acts. I think they're all deserving. I also voted for Jane's Addiction, Sinead O'Connor, Sade, and a little band I like to call Oasis. And none of those people got in. I have to say, I didn't vote for Mariah Carey, but I'm stunned that she didn't get in.
Yeah,
I thought that she was a lock to get in.
I can't believe it. Getting that number one Pitchfork song of the 90s just didn't fucking move the needle.
It just seemed like she had reached a point where she obviously has tremendous commercial success, but she's also now very critically acclaimed. You know, like this generation of critics loves Mariah Carey. She's regarded as one of the great pop stars of the 90s. I just thought with this class that she would have gotten in. I'm a little surprised that Sade didn't get in either.
Same.
Just because very well regarded. Although I guess judging by who did get in, like not famous enough. Dave Matthews Band, fine. In a vacuum, I'm fine with it. Even though I could complain about artists who didn't get in. To me, the egregious inductees this year are Foreigner and Peter Frampton. And look, I'm a classic rock guy. I grew up listening to classic rock radio. I don't hate either one of them. I'm not a big Foreigner fan really at all. There's some Peter Frampton songs I like. I respect his tenure as the guitarist in Humble Pie. Hats off to Peter Frampton. But the analogy I would make with them, and I'm going back to quarterbacks here, they're Trent Dilfer. You look at Trent Dilfer, nice career, won a Super Bowl with the Baltimore Ravens, nice resume, ended up on television. He's famous enough for me to use him as a reference point in this conversation. He's never going to the Pro Football Hall of Fame because everybody knows he's a journeyman. He's a journeyman quarterback. He's nice, but he was never considered the best or one of the best quarterbacks of his time, which is usually how in sports people decide who to vote for into the Hall of Fame, you look at their career and you're like, okay, how many Pro Bowls did they go to? How many All-Star games? Were they one of the best players of their era? If they weren't, they don't get in. Peter Frampton, Foreigner, they are at best B-level 70s rockers.
Yeah.
They should not be in. And to me, this spotlights, I'm going to keep banging this drum. This is my biggest complaint with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They are still biased against alt and indie rock bands from the 80s and 90s. There are so many great bands who are important bands from that time who haven't even gotten close to getting in. And I'll say Jane's Addiction is one of them, and I'll say Oasis is absolutely one of them. Foreigner and Peter Frampton, it's like, do we still have ponytailed 70-year-old record executives voting for this shit?
You tell me.
Why? I don't know who's in the field, but to me, it's like, are we just going to put every band from the 70s in? Like, are we just going to put everyone in?
Yeah, I want
like,
Bachman Turner Overdrive in there.
They're probably next.
Yeah. They might already be in as far as I know.
Man. I like BTO more than I like
Grand
Foreigner.
Funk. Yeah. Is Grand Funk
in? I like Grand Funk. No, I don't think they're in, but, you know, who knows? I mean, Oasis not getting in, I think, is stupid. I really think it's stupid. This is a band that has a song that's one of the most streamed songs ever in the history of, like, streaming music. You know, they are a popular band 15 years after they broke up. I don't understand not putting them in. It's stupid. And it's stupid to get upset about this stuff, but this particular thing, because I feel like there's a movement to say, well, all the good rock bands are in, so we should be broadening the scope to include other people in other genres, which I'm fine with. Like, I love that Tribe Called Quest got in. I voted for them. Like, I think rap groups should absolutely be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But there are so many great rock bands from, like, the non-boomer era that don't get in, ever. Or it takes forever for them to get in. It's upsetting to me, Ian. As you can tell by the tenor of my voice, I am ranting about this, but I think it's total and utter just incompetence and malpractice by the voters of this institution. It's stupid, Ian.
I'm going to hold up the other poll, to use a therapeutic term, and say that, you know, Peter Frampton was on Homer Palooza, Aqua Teen Hunger Force had the Foreigner Belt episode. You know, those are Hall of Fame moments, in my opinion. But yeah, I think that, look, as far as I'm concerned with, like, Foreigner, I want 6 months maybe where, like, every Journey song you hear in a movie or on the radio gets replaced with an equivalent Foreigner song. Like, I could deal with that. That's how I feel about Foreigner. And I vaguely remember, I think it was Mark Ronson was, like, starting an actual lobbying firm for Foreigner's right. inclusion because Mick Jones is his stepdad or something. Right. But yeah, I mean, this really doesn't make sense because, like, Mariah Carey, absolutely should have made it. You know, Sade probably could have made it on, like, some Kate Bush type shit. I wish we had, like, a phone line, like a call-in show, so we could have our listeners tell us whether they think, like, Foreigner's more like Kerry Collins or like Jeff Garcia than he is, Trent Dilfer. But, yeah, I mean, Oasis to me, like, I'm not actually surprised because when you look at, you know, Foreigner and you look at a Cool in the Gang and Ozzy, they are like greatness kind of spread out over a longer period of time, whereas Oasis has been popular for a very long amount of time, but their greatness is very concentrated.
Yeah, but like, okay, then don't put in Guns N' Roses and don't put in the Sex Pistols. You know, like, there are other bands true. that GNR instantly got in.
But I think with Oasis, it's a matter of, like, them not being seen as, and I'm going to use, like, extremely big scare quotes as important, you know?
Well, I do think there's this bias against 80s and 90s bands, and it's even worse if you're not from America. I think British true. Bands, like, from that era are just totally... I mean, look how long it took for The Cure to get in. The Cure!
How long did it take to get in?
It took them years to get in. It took them many... I mean, they would have been... I think they finally got in 2019. Their first record, I believe, came out... Was 79. It 78?
Yeah, 78 79. Or 79.
So they would have been eligible in 2004. So it took them 15 years to get in.
Yeah, I wish we could pipe in that clip that you posted of Robert Smith at the on the red carpet.
Right.
Yeah, that shit was amazing.
The woman who's like, "Oh, how excited are you?" And Robert Smith's like, well, not as much as you. It's like, it's Robert Smith. Come on. He's not going to be doing jumping jacks here about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not hating on Foreigner and Peter Frampton. I'm not hating on Trent Dilfer. Trent Dilfer has a Super Bowl ring, you know, like most, like many players don't, you know, like Dan Marino doesn't have a Super Bowl ring, but Dan Marino is better than Trent Dilfer. Like no one would make that argument, you know, no one would argue against that. Dan Marino, another great indie band from the 80s. Yeah, I don't know. It's just infuriating to me. It's stupid to get mad about, but I'm going to keep banging this drum. I think it's a stupid, egregious bias that they need to get rid of. They need to dropkick these graying ponytails out of the voting pool ASAP.
Oh, again, I'm going to push back just a little and say I kind of want Oasis to not get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame every year because, you know, in lieu of getting any music or a reunion, I think the Gallagher brothers commenting on getting rejected from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is like way better than like what they would say if they actually got in. So have they released some sort of statement? Do you think they want to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Everyone says it doesn't matter, but how can it not be flattering to get in? I'm sure if you get it, there's some part of you that must
feel you get satisfied. Like a gift. You get a gift bag that's like really awesome, you know?
It's like, look, I make fun of the Grammys all the time. If someone gave me a Grammy, I'd be freaking thrilled.
Liner notes, baby. So, you do get the liner notes one.
I'm working on it. All right, let's change the subject here to something that's not so annoying. let's talk about the new album from the Austin duo Howdy. Now, for those who don't know about this band, they formed back in 2014, made up of two dudes named Charlie Martin and Will Taylor. They formed the band back in 2014, and they put out 5 albums, including their latest, which is out today, and it's conveniently called Howdy. And I guess you could call this a double record. I believe there's like 18, 19 songs or so, although it only clocks in at an hour. And I say only as a positive thing. This is a very efficient record, checking through these songs. And this band, they came into my consciousness with their previous record, which came out in 2021, which was called True Love. Really cool record. Big fan of that album. Very likable record. If patio music were a genre, I feel like Howdy is specifically making music targeted at the patio demographic. It just sounds great out in the sunshine, sitting on some sort of wood structure, sipping a beverage. I've actually test driven this album, this new album already on the patio, Pass with Flying Colors. Curious to get your take on this band, Ian. Did you write about this record?
I did. I don't think it's going to publish like tomorrow when this episode would run. But like, you know, I'm writing about this album for Pitchfork. And
okay, so you're reviewing it.
I am reviewing it. And
so can you hint at all? Well, we know you like the record. Yes. We'll see what the score is. But the way I describe this album is, or this band, I guess generally, is to me they're like Japan Droids if they sounded like Alex G. Because it's two guys, and it seems like they're best friends. There's a lot of warmth coming from their friendship. It just seems like their songs are about celebrating life and being together and just the good vibes of it. But it doesn't sound at all like Japan Droids. It just has that Alex G fractured folk rock, you know, with some, like, you know, pop influences infused in there as well. Does that make sense to you as a descriptor for this band?
Yeah, I like how we both, like, separately came up with the similar, hey, if Japan Droids sounded like X. I mean, like, first off, you know, it's got the both of them, like, arm over shoulder on the album cover, very Celebration Rock-esque. I said I feel like it was Japan Droids if, you know, they grew up as Texas jocks and they still liked each other. yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Friday Night Lights, the album.
Exactly, yeah. Because, yeah, they actually lit. It's interesting because, you know, they moved out of Austin. You know, they got married. I think one of them has kids now. They live in Nashville and St. Louis, respectively. But, yeah, this is... I also like the fact that, like, Charlie Martin, Will Taylor, like, they're named after, like, their last names are both really expensive acoustic guitars. I don't know if that means anything, but, yeah, they're the sort of band that, like, I've enjoyed on a song-by-song basis over the past few years. you know, like they never really struck me as a band that would make the leap or even attempt to make the leap. Like you were saying, it was kind of in that, if you like Alex G, check out this band too. But, you know, they've done well. I know a lot of people who like them. Very, very charming. I like the fact that they covered Coldplay's Warning Sign on a covers yes. EP. And I think this really unlocked something in them because, yeah, it's like 19 songs, but it's only like 54 minutes long. And this is the sort of, I guess, album five leap that you don't typically see because, you know, like the NBA, if we're going to, you know, harp on the sports cast beat, you know, the NBA just announced like their most improved player. And that typically is like a first round draft pick who, you know, kind of struggles in their rookie year. And then they go ahead and like become an all-star in year two or three, you know, they become the player that you always thought they would be. You know, and you don't see someone in year eight or nine get it. In the same way, sometimes with bands, when they make, quote, the leap, it's on album two or three where, like, the first one had some potential, but they hadn't really figured it out yet. Like, Howdy was, like, consistent, and they were charming, and they got better and better with each album. But this one is, like, a pretty significant jump over True Love, which I really, really liked, and Heavy Lifter, which features Ruin My Ride, which might be the best porch music video ever made, you know, by any rocker. It's unbelievable. I get so, it's sort of like what happened with Rat Boys last year. I think that's like the comparison I'd make, where it's like they were maybe like, you know, a band that could play a festival, wouldn't top line. I don't think this is going to make them famous or anything like that, but if you like anything that we talk about here on this podcast, you're going to dig it. I mean, I think between this and the Good Looks album that's coming out in a month, like we got like a bumper crop of porch music. We need like a Wild Pink album to materialize from this.
You know, like a Good Looks Howdy tour of patios would be amazing. they should just play patios this summer. Like roll up to, you know, just go to like resort communities, like wherever there's like maybe like a nice outside eating area by a lake, and just like roll up. You know, because usually those places have some sort of like open mic stage setup. Just roll up in there, play some strummy tunes, yeah, and watch the sun go down.
Lake Mendota in Madison, Wisconsin. I was there last summer. Ooh. Yeah, that's the kind of place they should be playing.
Mendota, a Mendota shout out, man. I love it. Yeah, it's interesting because I felt like True Love and this record are the ones I know the best. I haven't investigated deep on the previous three records, but there is an element of this band where, like, if you want to talk about Alex G being Nirvana, Howdy in a way is like Pearl Jam, in that it's like a more sort of welcoming, warm-hearted, and populist version of what Alex G does. Even though Alex G is obviously a very popular artist, but he, I think, is like a little more eccentric mm-hmm. on his records. He's a little more experimental, maybe takes more chances. Howdy to me is in this comfort zone of taking that Alex G aesthetic and really making, and really kind of having like the warmth come out. I'm going to use the word warmth again, because that's what I get from this band. It's a very sort of like, if you want to hang out with your pals, this is a good record to play. It just has such good vibes to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like good vibes music, it's easy to undersell that because it's not something that is considered artistically exciting. And yet from a lifestyle perspective, that's the kind of thing that people need. Like, you need good vibes music, especially as we approach the summertime. And I think that this record will be just a perfect accompaniment for cookouts galore in the indie rock community. Like the indie rock community, if you're going to be grilling things, you're going to want this Howdy album in your life.
Yeah, I don't know if this line made it in the review, but I said that you could probably make a drinking game out of like every time they say the word love, friend, or like a family or friend name, or like a interstate in the southern United States, take a drink. Because, you know, you'll probably be like three beers deep in this by the time it's done. And that's like, this is like a three beer buzz type of record. It's like when you get it just right. Cause like, yeah, it is good vibes. Cause like they sing about family and they sing about friends and they sing about like positive memories. And, I'm like really interested to see how the edit comes out. Cause I like warned them in advance, like, man, I get kind of cornball with this shit, but, you know, we'll see. Yeah, I know. I really get into my emotions.
Well, if they cut out the cornball shit, you need to release the cornball cut. You know, we need the cornball cut because that's where the good stuff is, man. I like the cornballness. And you need a little bit of cornballness in a record review. If it's a positive review and you love it, you got to have some of that in there.
It's radically cornball. I should have said that. Right. Unapologetically cornball.
Yep, exactly. Well, let's get to our mailbag segment. It's great to hear, as always, from our listeners. If you want to hit us up, we're at indiecastmailbag@gmail.com. Ian, you want to read this email?
All right. Hello, Stephen and Ian. Recently, Menomina, guaranteed Ian Yeh, unknown Stephen verdict, released new music, and I swear within 3 seconds of listening, it was hard to exaggerate how obviously it sounded like a Menomina song. I know some bands like Interpol and The National who have collaborated with Menomina and Elvi for some primo, remember, some side projects material, get flack for always sounding the same, but sometimes a band and an artist just have a singular sound. Do you have any examples you'll always defend, or some hater ones? To me, all Spencer Krug projects really always sound like him, whether in Wolf Parade, Sunset, Rubdown, etc., and I really appreciate that. Also, Moonface, I'm going to throw that in there. I've gone on too long, but thanks. Been a day one listener, and frankly don't want to think about how long I've read your works. Thank you, Dan in Lakewood, Ohio. That sounds like a stop on the Howdy Porch music tour.
I was going to say Lakewood, Ohio would be a good band name. I like that. I would totally listen to Lakewood, Ohio. I just picture them. Definitely have some pedal steel in that band. Bunch of flannel.
I don't know. People. Defiance, Ohio. It might be folk punk.
Yeah, it could. Yeah, that could be. That could be like a British post-punk band too, like just someone, because, you know, just like that band Mandy, Indiana, you know, maybe there's going to be someone ripping them off,
picking out
Lakewood, Ohio. You know, this is an interesting question because it does get back to that idea of sounding like yourself being a good or bad thing. I feel like sometimes people complain about, oh, this just sounds like them, like they're doing this, like, oh, like Bradford Cox, even if he's an Atlas Sound or a Deer Hunter, it just sounds like Bradford Cox. I don't think that's a negative at all. I think having a distinctive sound is the mark of a great artist, even if it's an artist, or maybe not even a great artist, just an artist in general. You know, if you're an artist, you have a personality. You know, if you're someone who can just sound like anybody, I actually think that's kind of, that can be kind of hacky. You know, you can just be someone who, you know, you're like an impressionist. You're not someone who has your own voice. So I don't know. This is a hard one for me to answer because I feel like any artist this could apply to. Is there someone that you feel like this applies more to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we got to give a shout to Mike Kinsella. Of course, he's got a new album as Owen out today. And it's funny because, like, he's made so many side projects, you know, whether it's American Football or, you know, Owen or just any of his, like, it always sounds like him. Like, his voice is so unmistakable. I think the same is true with Connor Oberst and Ben Gibbard. And I think it's true with all these guys because they not only sing the same way in numerous projects, but they write the same exact way. They have very, very distinct ways of, like, writing lyrics. And
I mean, is there an example of someone who doesn't sound like themselves? Like, they did a side project and you're like, holy shit, I can't believe they did that. I think that's a much tougher question because, you know, like I could say, like, there's a million Robert Pollard side projects that just sound like Guided by Voices. Like, I wouldn't know it was a Guided by Voices song or like a Lexo and the Leapers song or something. But to me, it's a lot harder to answer the question, who has a side project where you're like, wow, I would never have guessed that was them. Like, that to me, like, nothing's coming to mind for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes you see, like, electronic side projects, for example. Right. Like, you know, that's a big part of it. Or, you know, like, I just think of, like, all the electron, like, the dubstep type instrumentals that come on a 1975 record. You know, if you were just, like, to portion them out, you wouldn't know it's them. But, you know, even if it is within their, you know, realm of influences. But yeah, I think it's interesting because, like, if there were better versions of this phenomenon, like artists who don't sound like themselves, we'd probably remember it. But the ones we do remember are the ones that fall into, like, fall under the umbrella of this, like, really, really distinct sensibility. Also, I love the fact that he talked about Interpol sounding the same, even though Paul Banks has made, like, several rap albums.
Right. I guess that would be an example.
Everyone on my dick like they're supposed to be. We always need, like, to find a way to talk about that.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect that. So I guess that's an example. But that's also an example of thinking, well, maybe he should just sound like Interpol. You know, maybe it was a bad idea to sound different from what they did.
Did we get your verdict on Menomina yet, though?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I don't have a strong take on them, really. I've listened to them. I guess I'll say yay because I've enjoyed them, but I haven't gone deep with them. I have to say, I've probably listened to Elvi more than Menomina, and I'm a Elvi defender. I like Elvi. I like that record, Return to the Moon. And I know I'm alone on that on this show. I've actually seen Elvi live. That's how deep I go with Elvi. But yeah, I like that record. But that's probably the most experience I have with Menomina, really. Like, where should I get started with Menomina?
It's funny because, like, they have the Elvi project, and I think there was another one. One of the other guys started with another guy in that remote. I forget, it's something Falls in the name. I can't believe I'm, like, failing remember some guys test. And I think one of the guys also ended up joining Bloc Party as the bassist. So very interesting post career. But I would start with the first three albums. I Am the Funblame Monster is awesome. Minds is, like, one of the most down bad albums from an indie rock band you'll ever hear. It is just so fucking depressing, but it's great. And somewhere in between, I think Friend or Foe is probably the most popular one. But yeah, I mean, this thing, it sounds like I was immediately having, like, epic Bacon Bill Murray era flashbacks when I listened to this EP that came out, because so I think a lot of it is from 2000. Like, I think these are, like, B-sides that were reanimated. And one of them actually has Brent Knopp singing lead again, which is amazing because Menomina, if they're known for anything outside of their music, it's that, like, they are a band notorious for, like, really hating each other. There was an article in Portland. They're from Portland. They're in, like, a Portland Alt Weekly just about, like, how... like, just how awful it was to be in that band. They were just fighting all the time. And so I'm hoping that, you know, time has healed those wounds. And maybe we'll get some music. I mean, I don't think any of their albums has totally knocked it out of the park. Friend of Foe is probably the most consistent. Minds has the highest peaks. And Moms, the last one they made, it has its moments. But I think they were kind of running its course. It wasn't as good without Brent. So, yeah, love talking Menomina.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I'll start digging into Menomina. We've now reached the part of our episode that we call Recommendation Corner, where Ian and I talk about something that we're into this week. Ian, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I had trouble picking one because there are just a lot of really cool under-the-radar things that have come out recently. I'll just going to quickly give a shout to Oolong Self-Titled and the new Goalie's Anxiety at the Penalty Kick record. But I wanted to talk specifically about a record came out last week from a band called CU Space Cowboy. The album's called Coup de Grace, because we got to celebrate San Diego excellence wherever we can get it. This is a band that's taken up the mantle of what people often call sasscore.
they often call it that.
Yes, they do. It emerged out of San Diego in the early 90s. It was, you know, White Belts, Spock haircuts, The Locust, Nation of Ulysses. To people who are my age and not dialed into that stuff, I'll just say it sounds like the Blood Brothers. And this album is really going for it in a way that you don't hear that often, because they've gotten, like, more melodic and accessible over time. But there are riffs on this album that are pretty clear ripoffs of Bloc Party's Banquet and also Andrew W.K.'s Party Hard. But
wow.
But multiply that by AFI going major label on Sing the Sorrow. I love the fact that it came out on the same day on the same label as the Cloud Nothings album. Shout out to Pure Noise. Y'all are killing it this year. It's like, it's an acquired taste for sure. And, you know, I'm just going to preface by saying it was produced by the guy who did the first Panic at the Disco record. But yeah, it's an amazing, it's just like an amazing piece of work in what it does. It's a lot of fun. I think you might find some parts that you enjoy. They're just going for it. And I love that for them.
I got to say, some of the description that you just gave is not enticing me. Yeah. But if you think I would enjoy parts of it, I'll take your word for it. You know, I want to talk about the new Justice album that's out today, Hyperdrama, because I am a fan of French electronic music in general, and Justice in particular. But I haven't heard this record yet, so I can't in good conscience recommend it. I have enjoyed the singles though, so I have high hopes that this is going to be a good record. So just wanted to mention that there's a new Justice album out today. Instead of that, I'm gonna go old school here. I'm gonna go with an album that I think I would have inducted into the IndieCast Hall of Fame, but I don't want to wait to do that, so I'm going to talk about it in Recommendation Corner. It's an album called Earth, Sun, Moon, and it's by a band called Love and Rockets. And I've been listening to this record a lot lately. I've been revisiting it. And I just feel like this band is a little unsung when we talk about bands from the 80s that came from England and were involved in the alternative rock of that era. You know, we know about The Cure, obviously. We know about Bauhaus. We know about Echo and the Bunnymen. Love and Rockets gets a little lost in the shuffle there. But their albums, Earth, Sun, Moon, and the self-titled Love and Rockets record, which came out in 1989, which has the song So Alive. And if you know any Love and Rockets song, it's probably So Alive. That's like their big hit. Awesome song. Like just one of the great late 80s alt-rock hits. This band, I just love their aesthetic. You've got drum machines. You've got like a lot of drone. You have acoustic guitar. And you have this sort of like Jim Morrison-y type singer. And it just has tons of vibe, kind of psychedelic, kind of garage rock. I feel like if this band is unsung and people start rediscovering Love and Rockets, this record sounds so contemporary to me. I feel like it could be easily ripped off and like turned into something new. Again, it's got like a little bit of a goth vibe to it as well. Just a really cool band, and I just want to bring them back into greater consciousness, particularly, again, Earth, Sun, Moon, which came out in 87, and the self-titled record. If you like that era of like British alt-rock, atmospheric music, and you haven't listened to this band, I think you're really going to love it. So going old school here today, a potential IndieCast Hall of Fame candidate for me, Earth, Sun, Moon by Love and Rockets. Have you ever listened to this band?
I'm a So Alive only person, but I like the potential because, of course, you know, when I heard it on the radio as like, in elementary school, I didn't think, oh, this is like really in the realm of like Jim Morrison and T-Rex. I think that song gives me a sense they might be getting kind of himbo with it, which I always love. And
that's like them. Yeah, that's them being straight. This record that I'm talking about came out before that. It's not as himbo-ish.
Okay.
It's a little more, it feels like a little more kind of 60s influence, like a little more, again, psych rock. The self-titled record is definitely more streamlined, and again, in a great way. Like, that's a record that you could play in strip clubs, and it would totally work.
It's the more human than human of late 80s British rock. But no, I'll check it out, because like, you were definitely on the money when you recommended The Waterboys. And like, I listened to that, and I'm like, holy shit, how have I like missed this my whole life? And I think this will be a good one to go to. Also, the only thing I learned a little bit about Love and Rockets, because when Jane's Addiction was coming up, and I did the Sunday review of Nothing Shocking, Jane's Addiction went on tour with Love and Rockets back when they were kind of nobodies, and they would just get like booed like off the stage every time.
See, that would be an amazing tour. That would actually, that pairing makes a lot of sense too. Like, those bands actually would be amazing together. Love and Rockets fans, don't boo Jane's Addiction. Come on. That about does it for this episode of IndieCast. We'll be back with more news and reviews and hashing out trends next week. And if you're looking for more music recommendations, sign up for the Indie Mixtape newsletter. You can go to uproxx.com/indie, and I recommend 5 albums per week, and we'll send it directly to your email box.